Welcome back to the Monday Muse. I'm Lee Benson. The other day, I was walking by one of my bookshelves, and I saw a book on my shelf that I have not read in a long time. The book was Showings by Julian of Norwich. Julian of Norwich is a 14th century English mystic who, at the age of 30, she began to receive a series of visions or showings of the Passion of Christ. After she recovered from her illness, she wrote down some of her experiences and visions in this book, Showings. Now, one of her more controversial or fascinating insights that she wrote down was that she called God and Christ mother. And that's what we're going to get into today, calling God mother. Before we begin, remember to like, comment, share, subscribe, do all the things. Help me to appease the fickle and pernicious algorithm gods. Also, I'd like to know your thoughts on today's topic in the comments below. So let me know what you think about calling God mother. Calling God mother is nothing new, of course. We know this from ancient history, but also even in our own contemporary time where people kind of are pushing for more feminine language for God or insisting that God has no gender or the like. But I think that Julian of Norwich has a very interesting insight on this. I think that she takes the appropriate route. And that's what I'm going to get into. I'm going to talk a little bit about Julian of Norwich, her writings, and of course, a little bit of Jung on this as well. So again, there's nothing new about this long tradition about God as mother. The church has kind of always been aware of the maternal aspect of God. And there's even some theological formulations of it, especially in regards to providence. Saint Augustine, Saint Anselm use similar language about God in more feminine terms. Certainly, Bridget of Sweden and Catherine of Siena. We have from scripture itself, the motherly imagery from Isaiah. Like a son is comforted by his mother, I will comfort you. That's God talking to his people, Israel. So Julian, she did not invent this theme. She didn't invent the theme of calling God mother. But what makes her contribution original or unique is the theological precision that she applies the symbolism of the feminine to the Trinitarian relationships or the inner relationships of the Trinitarian life. So for her, fatherhood in the Trinity means power and goodness, and motherhood means wisdom and lovingness. Her theological approach is relevant to our own time and to making sense of even past traditions. Many traditions point to the presence of God as mother or as feminine. But underlying Julian's approach, her theology is the idea of totality. For Julian, the reason why she makes reference to God as father and references God as mother is because of the totality of God, that God is all of these things. So what develops in Julian's idea is not an idea of femininity as opposed to or distinct from masculinity. Femininity and masculinity are joined together. But the idea of motherhood of God, the motherhood of God, as a complement to that of his fatherhood. So Julian does not introduce in her approach to God the vocabulary or symbolism of sex, which is, you know, according to its etymology, sex is to divide, or it's a division. It's a section. It's a part. It's opposed to totality. So thus, when Julian conceives the quality of mother or sees motherhood in the Trinity, she also sees that as complementary to Father, Son, and Spirit. It's the plenitude of life. It is to be sure that she focuses on the motherhood of God as opposed to the fatherhood of God more in her writings. But still, within her writings, she does not substitute the idea of motherhood of God for that of fatherhood. What Julian wants to do is she wants to unite fatherhood and motherhood in the totality of God. So she works for an integration of all that is best of what we can conceive and experience in God. So she has a theological synthesis that is the result of her own psychological, spiritual, and mystical integration, that through her experiences and understanding, she attempts to grasp the total mystery of God and communicate it. Of course, she attempts to grasp it in a very limited sense because no one can grasp the totality of God. But to the best of her ability, what she's trying to do is to communicate that God is the totality of motherhood, the totality of fatherhood. But these are not distinct. They're not opposed to each other, which I think is what we get into in the modern world. When we assert that God is mother, sometimes it's almost antagonistic to his fatherhood. That is not what Julian is trying to do. She's not trying to be polemic. She's not trying to be divisive. She's not trying to be political or something, or to assert the feminine over the masculine. Again, she focuses mostly on motherhood as opposed to fatherhood, but that's just to highlight the totality again. That's to highlight a specific aspect of God. And this is in the 13th and 14th century. So perhaps, although again, there's a longstanding tradition of this, it isn't the predominant tradition. So she's going out on a limb here. Thus, we can say that for Julian, God is almighty as a loving father. And again, God as wisdom is an all-loving mother. So she says that God is truly our father, and so truly is God our mother. He has revealed that in everything, I am the power and goodness of fatherhood. I am the wisdom and lovingness of motherhood. So the father is the one who wills, the mother is the one who works, and the spirit is the one who confirms, she writes. God is the true father and the true mother of natures, she says. That all natures which he has made flow from him to work his will, and they will be restored and brought back to him. So this is a very popular idea that I've been trying to work out with Logos theology, the writings of Pseudo-Dionysius, the writings of Maximus the Confessor, which I'll get into later in this podcast. But the idea that you have a primal unity, and from that unity flows multiplicity. So God is the author, she says, of motherhood, and God is the author of fatherhood. So both primordially are contained in the unity of God. He's not one or the other. He's the totality of both, united in himself. So motherhood flows from God and will return back to him. Of course, as I'm reading about masculine and feminine in God, Jung comes to mind, of course. This is something he talks about a lot. And also Father Victor White commenting on Jung and his own thoughts and such. But we can take a little bit of a look into the Old Testament, psychology, and philosophy, theology on this topic. So if we look at the Old Testament, God is unmistakably masculine. He is king, he's lord, he's lawgiver. He's jealous of other gods and certainly other goddesses. No one else may be worshipped beside him. But unlike many of the gods of the ancient world, or the gods of the pagans in antiquity, he has no divine consort. He has no lover. He has no mother. He has no sister, no family. It's just Yahweh, God alone. And this becomes more fascinating, if we look at the history of religions, to recall that the Israelites go into Canaan. And in the heart of Canaan are many pagan religions, certainly the cult of Baal and such. But certainly in the land of Canaan, there would be the cult of the Great Mother, the cult of fertility. There's also throughout the Old Testament, there's the conflicts of temple prostitution and the like. So that's the contest of Israel always. So God's function in his relationship to his people, the Israelites, is very different than other deities. He is not primarily concerned with the renewal of the world, with fertility, with the kind of the functions of the land and such like that, but he's primarily concerned with human history. He enters into time to work on, with his people towards a final goal. This is a unique introduction of the sacred history of man. For the pagan world, history is secular, is a circle, it's secular. And for the Jews and for Christians, it's linear. We're moving towards a destination. Of course, someone like St. Bonaventure will come along and unite the two. But for the sake of a brief difference, God is not, the God of the Israelites is not concerned with this eternal cycle of renewal, but with this movement towards a final destination. So he does not function as other gods do. Rather, he calls Abraham from a land, and he calls Moses from Egypt to go towards a specific land of Canaan, the promised land. And this does not take place. This is something unique about Revelation, the Judeo-Christian revelation, the revelation of the Old Testament and New, is these events do not take place in a mythical anytime. That's what Mircea Eliade calls it, the mythical anytime. It takes place in history. It takes place in definitive places that you can go to and see. So it's not this cosmology that takes place up in the heavens only and that's way out there, but it's taking place in the land of Canaan, in the land of Egypt and such. So God functions very differently then. God, the God of Israelites, functions very differently. Nonetheless, God is masculine, and he's celibate. He's unaccompanied by any foreign goddess. And this phenomenon is, I think, something that we maybe don't appreciate if we look at the history of religions, because almost all religions have some sort of divine consort. Again, there's a great mother and a great father that gives birth to all of creation. But that is not true with Yahweh. So this phenomenon is important if we remember the extreme universality of the goddess, that she is everywhere and has many names in history and archaeology and such, bear witness to the symbolism of the Great Mother, of the goddess. So the Old Testament does bear witness to the extent to which human nature and of the Israelites abhors the missing feminine, the vacuum of the feminine, that there's many times in which the Israelites are prone to worship the feminine. The cult of the Great Mother, again, is well established in Canaan, and devotees of Yahweh, of the Israelite people, are in constant conflict with the gods of the nature religions centered on the goddess. This happens with the prophet Elijah and the prophets of Baal or the disciples of Baal, although in that particular instance, it may not be exactly an attack on feminine deities, but kind of by extension, Jeremiah deals with this. He complains of women, the Israelite women who are making cakes to the king, to the queen of heaven. Ezekiel in exile in Babylon sees in a vision women in the streets weeping over Ishtar, the suffering and the suffering of the gods of the Babylonians. So Israel is in constant conflict with other gods and goddesses. And part of this is also the ritual prostitution, the drama of or reenactment of the sacred marriage of the god and the goddess, again, for the renewal of the world and fertility. There's some later evidence that I've seen and has been pointed out by different scholars on the internet of there was a divine consort or a female deity, a Canaanite deity that was assigned to Yahweh at one point. However, this was later kind of taken out or fought against when there were reforms of the Old Testament or the writings of the Old Testament, which makes sense. That's a topic I can get into another time. but it was a kind of a sacrilege or a blasphemy that the Israelites were committing by trying to give Yahweh, again, the lone God, trying to give him something like a wife that he didn't need. But again, there's this vacuum of the feminine that the Israelites seem compelled to fill. So Jung, of course, comments on the bad behavior of Yahweh or God in the Old Testament. He does this especially in Answer to Job, where Yahweh is, this is Jung's characterization, but Yahweh is cruel to his very loyal and loving servant, Job. And he says that this portrait of God begins to change later in the Old Testament when we get to the wisdom literature. And this really begins to change with the introduction of Sophia, wisdom personified. Wisdom in Greek is Sophia. And Sophia is the embodiment or is distinctly feminine. That's the word, the language used for Sophia is always in the feminine and even grammatically. So wisdom, Sophia, is personified as being eternally with the Lord, set up from eternity, from the beginning. According to Ecclesiastes, she's the mother of fair love. In later prophets, the Lord has already manifested himself as a father. But then even later, Isaiah says that he acts as a mother towards us. But even then, with Isaiah saying that he acts as a mother and this personified wisdom with the Lord, he is still pictured as a father with not a mother with no wife. Of course, that continues into the New Testament. But what Jung, I think, is trying to get at with Sophia is this idea that the feminine has this civilizing feature to the masculine, that men without women are uncivilized. They're sort of brutish and barbaric, but the feminine comes and kind of domesticates man, makes him civil. He's not so poorly behaved. So the idea is, of course, for Jung that Lady Sophia comes along, civilizes Yahweh, makes him behave better. We can get into that topic some other time, especially about the civilizing effects of the feminine. But let's continue on. So the question of the woman, of the maiden, the mother, the feminine in God, is that God is beyond all opposites, including the opposites of sex. Although we address God as Father, theologians teach that this form of address is only an expression of our creatureliness towards God. So if we recall Julian of Norwich, this is not to be taken literally, that this is Julian's experience of God as mother, not that he possesses the sex of the feminine or the sex of the masculine or male or female, but that the way in which God interacts with us or we interact with God is that of a loving mother. So St. Thomas Aquinas says that the name Father among us does not signify a person, but a relation of a person. So in God, however, it's not exactly the same. So it's when we speak of God as Father, what we're speaking of is a certain type of relationship with us, that fatherhood is subsisting in the person, in the person of the Father. And it's not necessarily to signify the literalness of Father in him. So Jung and others have argued that there's something essentially incomplete about the monosexuality or the male only, the masculine only figure of God, that everything is male or female. If we look out in nature, we look out in our experience of world, everything is male and female. Plants, animals, even electrical work has some male and female parts as we assign them. So everything that is sterile or powerless or incomplete, unless it is conjoined to its opposite, but once the counterpart is joined, then it becomes the opposite of those things. It becomes virile. It becomes powerful. It becomes complete. So the male and female divide penetrates the whole of reality. And power and completeness can only come with the union of the opposites, by the reunion of male and female. If you read Plato's Symposium, he has a section about the original man and what original man looked like. And he says that our ancestors of mankind were hermaphrodites. They were, you know, I think it was a sphere, was it? But either way, man and woman were joined together physically, but they were split in two. They were split by the gods' jealousy. So man and woman were originally one thing, and then split, male and female. And now he says, each of us is a broken half, longing for the other half. So man, animals, the whole of nature, again, divided into male and female. And we can see this in Chinese philosophy as well, has a division of everything into opposites. You have the yin, which is feminine, dark, passive, and then you have the yang, the masculine, the light, the active. Yet this primitive duality of feminine and masculine, or the picture of masculinity as the complementary opposite of femininity, is overcome in God. Again, God transcends and is beyond opposites. God transcends this union of opposites in some ways. I guess he can be conceived as that, you know, with some caveats. But for the Christians, God is neither masculine nor feminine, but transcends this duality in all contraries. God is revealed in the Trinity as also unity. So the unity is conceived as the source of the processions of the Trinity of persons. So he may be figured as being and doing, as mother and father, as feminine and masculine, and so on. With the dogma of the Trinity, it corrects any impression that might suggest duality. God is the uncreated prototype of the contraries which permeate and differentiate creation. But in him, they are not contraries, but absolute unity. So we perceive duality. We perceive male, female, feminine, masculine, mother, father. But in God, we have to remember, he's absolute primal unity. So there is no, is God masculine or feminine or mother and father, divide in God, but the totality of both perfectly united. So in him, in God, the duality is overcome, or to be more exact, has not yet become dual. The duality and contrariety of divine pairs, of gods and goddesses, thus do not represent God. The gods and goddesses do not represent God, but rather they misrepresent God. So male and female otherness is thus not to be found in God, but only in the relationship of God to the creature. That in God is all the prototypes in supreme perfection. So in God is the supreme perfection of motherhood and fatherhood. So we can say that God stands both in singularity as well as in multiplicity, that one flows many and flows back to one. This is the idea of Logos theology again, that God in a single point in unity, there are multiplicity of parts that represent that one, but then when they're all gathered back, they're all gathered back into one. So we see in Genesis that man and woman are made in the image of God. So from this, we can deduce that femininity, no less than masculinity, has a divine prototype. But again, God transcends these categories. Yet this multiplicity does not does manifest some truth about God. Multiplicity does represent truth about God. All created things are somehow pre-contained, we would say, in the divine being and in wisdom. Therefore, those of motherhood and fatherhood are also contained in God. The prototypes are pre-contained in God of both those two aspects. So, to answer the question, this is Jung's question, where is the feminine? The answer seems clear for the Christian. We would say, the feminine is not in the heavens. It's not with God. It's not a divine being. It's not a divine consort to God. It's not in the creator, but in the creature. Earth itself, creation itself, is represented as feminine to God. We can even go further and say all of mankind is feminine to God. God, in the very first chapters of Genesis, asks Adam and Eve to be docile, to be obedient, and demands fertility of all of mankind. All of these, this obedience and fertility, are archetypally or symbolically feminine qualities. So from all mankind, God chooses one insignificant people, one insignificant and undeserving people, and with them he enters into a covenant. And there are many ways to understand the covenant relationship, but one of them, the one term that is preferred by the prophets, is that of marriage, that the covenant of God with Israel is a marriage. So the covenant that he enters into with them as a marriage means that worship or sacrifice of any kind given to other gods is adultery or harlotry, that they are giving themselves away to another spouse or to another person that is not their spouse. But the fact that God's people are God's wife, of course, does not prevent the Israelites from personifying other things as mother. You know, in Isaiah 66, he talks about Mother Jerusalem, Jerusalem as the mother. But of course, and there's other parts where this happens in the Psalms. There's a royal wedding psalm where that represents the people as the bride of God, and of course for Christians, the church becomes mother, and the church becomes the bride of Christ. St. Paul talks about the image of Christ in the church as Christ giving himself up for his bride. So the church is a feminine figure in Christian imagery from the beginning. And of course, the other great feminine imagery in Christianity is we have Eve, we have Mary, and we have the church all combined together. So the church, all three of these are connected because the church is seen as the new Eve, the mother of all the living, brought forth from the side of Christ as he was dying on the cross. His pierced side is what gave birth to the church. This is, of course, harkening back to the rib taken from the side of Adam that creates Eve. So Mary is also connected to this. Mary is called the new Eve, and she's seen as a personification of Holy Mother Church. St. Irenaeus even connects Mary to kind of a new earth mother, a mother of the earth. So the elimination, though, of any feminine figure from religion, in Jung's view, has brought an impoverishment to, he believes, the Protestant worldview. And he says that it has serious psychological and social problems, that to eliminate the religious imageries or the religious images and symbols of the feminine, he says, is to help bring the whole world to the brink of disaster. Jung writes, "The Protestant has lost the sacred images that expressed important conscious factors, together with the ritual, which from time immemorial has been a safe way of dealing with unpredictable forces of the unconscious. A vast amount of energy has thus been liberated, and instantly went off into the old channels of curiosity. In this way, Europe has become the mother of dragons that devoured the greater part of the earth. So Jung is saying that this is in the context of the papal proclamation about the Assumption, that Catholics still kind of contain this idea of the importance of the feminine, although Mary is not divine, but still very important. But for the Protestant who has mainly suppressed Marian devotion for favoring kind of immediacy with God and with Christ, this has psychological impacts, according to Jung. So Jung was critical of the Protestant reaction to the Assumption. And about the Assumption, Jung writes, "Mary was the instrument of God's birth and has so become involved in the Trinitarian drama as a human being. The Mother of God can therefore be regarded as a symbol of man's essential participation in the Trinity." So Jung is aware in his writings that Mary in the Assumption does not become a goddess. But he seems kind of disappointed about this fact, that Mary does not become a co-equal person. However, Jung is correct insofar as Mary is an image of our essential participation in the Trinity. That man does enter to some degree into this inner Trinitarian life by grace. Of course, you know, with writings of Eastern Fathers on theosis and writings like St. Teresa of Avila and St. John of the Cross on deification in the West, the heights of the spiritual life and the goal, really, of the spiritual life and the sacramental life and the life of grace is to be deified, to become like God again. Again, you will always remain human. You have a human nature that cannot change. But through grace, you will actually enter into the life of the Trinity. You will become like Mary in that sense, that you will be assumed in and enter into the life of the Trinity. That's the heights that we're called to. That's the whole goal, again, the end point of the spiritual life and the life of grace. Now, this falls into Jung's idea of there's a cosmic principle of wholeness, which is the four. You know, you have kind of the classic up, you know, top quadrant, bottom, left, right. And he says that the masculine Trinity of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit is missing the fourth quality. Depending upon what Jung's talking about, sometimes he says that this fourth quality is the shadow or sometimes evil. But in this case, the fourth quality that's missing is the feminine. So for Jung, wholeness and integration cannot happen without kind of both pairs. You have Father, Son, you know, Mother, maybe, or Matter and Spirit. So where is the matter? Where is the stuff, the Trinity, for Jung? That is specifically, where is the motherhood, the matter, and the feminine? So the psychological experience for Jung, he says, has shown that the integration of the shadow and the feminine principle of the anima are indispensable for human health and wholeness, and that if we disregard the feminine, what happens is it goes into the unconscious. It doesn't disappear. It goes someplace where we won't notice it. And this is at the root of, he says, the neurosis and the ills of our civilization of this time. So Jung argues, Christian symbols appear to exclude the feminine and the shadow, and so provide no means of their integration. And because there's no means of their integration, this ensures that they have devastating repression and that they will pop up in other ways. So that's a little bit of the talk of the feminine in relation to God. How do we use this language? Perhaps another time, I feel like it's just a little bit out of the scope of what I wanted to talk about. We can examine whether or not Jung is correct about this idea that the suppression of the feminine imagery in Christianity has led to some of the things that we see today. That could be a fascinating discussion. Or is it even true that we suppress the feminine? Catholicism really uplifts the feminine quite a bit. Of course, it's not divine. Mary's not divine, and we don't have any truly goddess figures or anything like that. But Mary, as the Queen of Heaven, is pretty big. You know, she, of all the humans, you know, she's top. So that's really hard to beat. And of course, throughout the church's history, there's also many female saints. The role of women was uplifted in many ways by the introduction of Christianity into the ancient world, into the world of antiquity and the Roman Empire. But still, it's true. God remains principally Father. That's the language which we use. That's the language which Christ himself uses. So therefore, that's the language that I'm going to use principally. But I think there are a few points that are very important to remember, that if we speak of God as Mother and God as Father, this should be to express, one, the totality of God, that God can act towards us as a Father and as a Mother in unity, that they're not supposed to be opposed to one another. It's not a part of God is feminine, a part of him is masculine. No, they're fulfilled in God, and that masculinity and femininity on our side, on the creature's side, reflects something about the nature of God. That's true, that women reflect God's nature in a particular way, and men in a particular way. And their union really reflects an even greater mystery, not just separately men and women, but the union of the two as both something about the unity of the nature of God and Christ and his church. And we have to remember that our language that we use is often a reflection of our creatureliness towards God and our relationship towards God on this side of eternity. So I think I'm going to stop there for today. Thank you for listening. Remember, if you have any questions, you can email me at basicallyrelatedpodcast@gmail.com. Don't forget to comment what you think about today's topic down below. And like, comment, share, subscribe. Help me fight those pesky algorithm gods. Thank you for listening.